Who goes there? Uncanniness 1. No philosopher has ever satisfactorily answered the following question. Why should there be something rather than nothing? It seems a fair enough question on its face, but that it should even be asked may seem to some of us inexplicable, even preposterous. What the question suggests is our uneasiness with something. Alternatively, there is nothing troubling about nothing, because we cannot give it consideration. Something, on the other hand, allows or necessitates our experience of the uncanny. Whether we are speaking of something that evolved naturally or was made by the digits and opposing thumbs of humanity, whether it is animate or inanimate, that something may become uncanny to us, a contravention of what we think should or should not be. In the same way that most of us share a general pattern of feeling about what is right or wrong in a moral sense, we also share a general pattern of feeling about what is right or wrong with respect to the world and ourselves, an internal authority that judges entities and events as within or outside of customs of reality. In experiencing the uncanny, there is a feeling of wrongness. A violation has transpired that alarms our internal authority regarding how something is supposed to happen or exist or behave. An offense against our world conception or self-conception has been committed. Of course, our internal authority may itself be in the wrong, perhaps because it is a fabrication of consciousness based on a body of laws that are written only within us and not a detector of what is right or wrong in any real sense, since nothing really is right or wrong in any real sense. That we might be wrong about something being wrong would in itself be wrong, according to our internal authority, which would then send out a signal of the uncanny concerning its own wrongness that would be returned to it for another round of signaling on the principle that everything it knows is wrong, which is to say that something is always wrong. For the welfare of our functioning, however, we are insured against the adverse effects of an ever-cycling signal of uncanny wrongness by our inability to recognize it, although it might be going on all the time, thus accounting for our uneasiness about something. But we may still perceive other phenomena to be on the wrong side of right and wrong, things that should not happen or exist or behave in the way we feel they should. Even the most unexceptional things may impress us in this way. In no time at all, they may cease to be seen the way we usually see them, and come to be seen as something else, something we may not be able to name. This unsteadiness of quality and meaning in something, a puppet doll, for instance, repels our lasting inspection of it, for the longer this inspection goes on, the more we become lost in a paradoxical state of knowing and not knowing what was once known and familiar. And it is then that the question, why should there be something rather than nothing, may become lost in the inexplicable, even preposterous, ambition to resolve it without losing our minds to the uncanny. Everyday objects seem curiously liable to being perceived as uncanny, because we see them every day and know how they should be and should not be. One day those shoes on the floor of your clothes closet may attract your eye in a way they never have before. Somehow they have become abstracted from your world, appearances you cannot place, lumps of matter without a fixed quality and meaning. You feel confused as you stare at them. What are they? What is their nature? Why should there be something rather than nothing? But before your consciousness can ask any more questions, you dial it back so that your footwear seems familiar again and not uncanny in its being. You select a pair of shoes to wear that day and sit down to put them on. It is then that you notice the pair of stockings you are wearing and think of the feet they conceal and the rest of the body to which those concealed feet are connected and the universe in which that body is roving about with so many other uncanny shapes. What now? A voice from the other side of being seems to say. And what if you should look at yourself, the most everyday object there is, and feel at a loss to attach a quality and a meaning to what is being seen or what is seeing it? What now indeed? Uncanniness 2. A sense of the uncanny can be activated in the average mortal under various conditions. Principal among these conditions are those which cause us to feel that we are not what we think we are, which was touched on at the close of the previous section. In his groundbreaking essay on the psychology of the uncanny, the German physician and psychologist Ernst Jentsch analyzes this feeling and its origins. Among the examples of uncanny experience Jentsch proffers in his essay is one where individuals cease to appear integrated in their identity and take on the aspect of mechanisms, things of parts that are made as they are made and are all clockwork processes rather than immutable beings unchanging at their heart. As Jentsch explains, a confirmation of the fact that the emotion being discussed, the uncanny, is caused in particular by a doubt as to the animate or inanimate nature of things, or, expressed more precisely, as to their animatedness as understood by man's traditional view, lies in the way in which the lay public is generally affected by the sight of articulations of most mental and many nervous diseases. Several patients afflicted with such troubles make a quite decidedly uncanny impression on most people. What we can always assume from our fellow men's experience of ordinary life is the relative psychical harmony in which their mental functions generally stand in relation to each other, even if moderate deviations from this equilibrium make their appearance occasionally in almost all of us. This behavior constitutes man's individuality and provides the foundation for our judgment of it. Most people do not show strong psychical peculiarities. At most, such peculiarities become apparent when strong affects make themselves felt, whereby it can suddenly become evident that not everything in the human psyche is of transcendental origin, and that much that is elementary is still present within it, even for our direct perception. It is, of course, often in just such cases that much at present is generally accounted for quite well in terms of normal psychology. But if this relative psychical harmony happens markedly to be disturbed in the spectator, and if the situation does not seem trivial or comic, the consequence of an unimportant incident, or if it is not quite familiar, like an alcohol intoxication, for example, then the dark knowledge dawns on the unschooled observer that mechanical processes are taking place in that which he was previously used to regarding as a unified psyche. It is not unjustly that epilepsy is therefore spoken of as the morbus sacer, sacred disease, as an illness not deriving from the human world, but from foreign and enigmatic spheres, for the epileptic attack of spasms reveals the human body to the viewer, the body that, under normal conditions, is so meaningful, expedient, and unitary, functioning according to the directions of his consciousness, as an immensely complicated and delicate mechanism. This is an important cause of the epileptic fit's ability to produce such a demonic effect on those who see it. The brilliance of Jentsch's example is that it explicates the uncanny not as an objective quality of something in the outside world, but as a subjective experience of a perceiver of the outside world. This is how it is in real life. The uncanny is an effect of our minds, and nothing else. And yet, at least for the average onlooker in this case, the uncanny effectively originates in an objective stimulus, something that seems to have about it a power of its own. In the example given, the objective stimulus is an animate individual observed as behaving against animatedness as understood by man's traditional view, the offender here being an epileptic exhibiting unusual bodily motions in the midst of a seizure. The subjective reaction to the seemingly objective stimulus of the uncanny is the gaining of dark knowledge about the workings of individuals, including the onlooker of the epileptic in the midst of a seizure. More expansively stated, not only is the epileptic perceived as uncanny by the onlooker, unless the onlooker is a physician who understands epileptic seizures by the lights of modern medicine and not according to a traditional view, but the onlooker also perceives himself as uncanny because he has been made conscious of the mechanical nature of all human bodies and, by extrapolation, of the fact that Mechanical processes are taking place in that which he was previously used to regarding as a unified psyche. Neuroscientists are now familiar with some of these mechanical processes, as was Zapfe, who wrote in The Last Messiah, "All things chain together in causes and effects, and everything man wants to grasp dissolves before the testing thought." Soon he sees mechanics even in the so far whole and dear, in the smile of his beloved. The knowledge that we are not the idealized beings we thought, integral and undivided, does frighten some people, including physicians and neuroscientists. Yet even though we are not as we usually perceive ourselves to be, we can still continue in our accustomed ways if only we can quash the sense of being uncanny mechanisms in a world of things that may be transformed any time and anywhere. Such quashing is not often a problem in the so-called real world, but it must be a problem in the world of supernatural horror. Artistic invocations of horror are most successful when the phenomena they depict call up the uncanny, which, unlike Jentsch's example of seeing someone having an epileptic seizure, are genuinely threatening both from the outside and from within. This species of horror can only be provoked when the supernatural is conjoined with the uncanny, because not even physicians and neuroscientists can be comfortable with supernaturalism, either by the lights of modern medicine or by any other lights. Bloodthirsty vampires and ravenous zombies are prime examples in this context, because their intrinsic supernaturalism as the undead makes them objectively uncanny things that generate subjectively uncanny sensations. They are uncanny in themselves because they once were human but have undergone a terrible rebirth and become mechanisms with a single function: to survive for survival's sake. Necessarily, they also inspire a subjective sense of the uncanny in those who perceive them, because they divulge the dark knowledge that human beings are also things made as they are made, and may be remade, because they are only clockwork processes, mechanisms, rather than immutable beings unchanging at their heart. As uncanny mechanisms, vampires and zombies usually perform the mechanical act of reproduction with no weighty deliberation, or none at all, the replication of their kind being epiphenomenal to the controlling urge that drives them. This second consequence completes the requirements of a supernatural horror story to present a phenomenon that poses an uncanny threat from both outside and from within, which is the ultimate threat to ordinary folk who only want to live in a world and in a way that is natural and familiar to them and their families, even though they are darkly aware that this familiarity is a fabrication that may be invalidated. Both requirements of the uncanny are recognizable in such horror films as Invasion of the Body Snatchers and John Carpenter's The Thing, which belong only negligibly to the genre of science fiction and solidly to that of supernatural horror as cognate with the uncanny. In the former classic of cinema, human beings are replaced by physical doubles of themselves by an alien power, something pernicious in Jentsch's analysis of the layperson's perception of epilepsy, not deriving from the human world, but from foreign and enigmatic spheres. What business does this alien power have on our planet? It has come to protract the survival of its kind by recreating itself in our image. And that says all we need to know about its mechanics and intentions. They are the same as ours, only they threaten to replace the survival and reproduction of our species with the survival and reproduction of theirs. The methodology of this alien power is to make duplicates of us after we fall asleep, so that we will never again awaken as ourselves, but will be transformed into another sort of being altogether. Due to these transformations, everyone who has not been taken by the body snatchers suffers from two appalling uncertainties. One is that any other person may not be what they seem to be, human. The other is that they themselves will also be transformed once they go to sleep. But unlike becoming a vampire or a zombie, neither being a desirable state of being, our transformation into body snatchers, which, despite the pluralization in the film title, seem to be parts of a hive rather than uniquely individuated entities, does not look too bad, objectively speaking. Once absorbed by the alien power, the converted lose all the qualities they had as humans, except for one, that of contentment or happiness, if you like. They become quietists in their existence, which in the film appears the last thing that human beings want, preferring the agitations of the life they know. This reaction is understandable. No one wants to be other than they are, or think they are. That is a fate worse than death, the transformation in which you stop being you. And better to die than to live in an assimilated condition, even one that is permanently collected and reassuring, rather than vulnerable to the startling and dreadful. Our sense of the uncanny is too ingrained in us as beings that may not be what we think we are, but who will hold on for dear life to survive and reproduce as our own species, and not that of some alien power. John Carpenter's The Thing is quite similar in its ontological scheme to Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The motivations of The Thing are the same as those of the Body Snatchers, to survive and reproduce. Only its method is different, which results in a somewhat greater degree of uncanniness in this film than in the earlier one. Because the title creature has the ability to remake itself as any and all life forms without their knowledge, the characters in the film cannot be sure who is a thing and who is not, since those who are transmuted retain their former appearance, memories, and behaviors, even after they have become, in their essence, uncanny monstrosities from another world. This situation leaves the members of an Antarctic research station, in the vicinity of which the Thing's spacecraft crash-landed long ago, doubtful about which of them is a thing and which are still the individuals they seem to be. Naturally, those at the Antarctic station are invested in repressing any consciousness that they are things, just as those who witness someone in the midst of an epileptic seizure are invested in thinking that they are not things of parts that are made as they are made, and are all clockwork processes rather than immutable beings unchanging at their heart. By isolation, putting this possibility out of their minds, the latter can maintain their sense of being idealized beings, integral and undivided, and not mechanisms, human puppets who do not know themselves as such. They can also distract themselves from any petrifying news about human beings by watching films in which all of the characters suffer an uncanny doom that could not possibly have relevance to real life, since it is represented as an invasion from foreign and enigmatic spheres they believe have no place in our world, where we know who we are and who everyone else is, members of a species that exists to survive and reproduce, ordinary folk who have nothing to do with supernaturalism and the uncanny, and who are resistant to the pessimism of fictions like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and The Thing, whose principles all suffer death or deformation in their fight to hang on to their lives and their humanity. In protest to the mentality of ordinary folk, let us again call on the incorrigibly pixelated Professor Nobody. In his Pessimism and Supernatural Horror, Lecture 1, he accommodates us with a rejoinder to the average optimistic mortal and helps us recall some of the main themes of the present work. Madness, chaos, bone-deep mayhem, devastation of innumerable souls. While we scream and perish, history licks a finger and turns the page. Fiction, unable to compete with the world for vividness of pain and lasting effects of fear, compensates in its own way. How? By inventing more bizarre means to outrageous ends. Among these means, of course, is the supernatural. In transforming natural ordeals into supernatural ones, we find the strength to affirm and deny their horror simultaneously, to savor and suffer them at the same time. So it is that supernatural horror is a possession of a profoundly divided species of being. It is not a property held by even our closest relations in the holy natural world. We came into it as part of our gloomy inheritance when we became what we are. Once awareness of the human predicament was achieved, we immediately took off in two directions, splitting ourselves down the middle. One half became dedicated to apologetics, even celebration, of our new toy of consciousness. The other half condemned and occasionally launched direct assaults on this gift. Supernatural horror was one of the ways we found that would allow us to live with our double selves. By its employ, we discovered how to take all the things that victimize us in our natural lives and turn them into the very stuff of demonic delight in our fantasy lives. In story and song, we could entertain ourselves with the worst we could think of, overriding real pains with ones that were unreal and harmless to our species. We can also do this trick without trespassing on the real estate of supernatural horror, but then we risk running into miseries too close to home. While horror may make us squirm or quake, it will not make us cry at the pity of things. The vampire may symbolize our horror of both life and death, but none of us has ever been uprooted by a symbol. The zombie may conceptualize our sickness of the flesh and its appetites, but no one has ever been sickened to death by a concept. By means of supernatural horror, we may pull our own strings of fate without collapsing, natural-born puppets whose lips are painted with our own blood. Actors. Within the strictures of common-sense reality and personal ability, we can choose to do anything we like in this world, with one exception. We cannot choose what any of our choices will be. To do that, we would have to be capable of making ourselves into self-made individuals who can choose what they choose, as opposed to being individuals who simply make choices. For instance, we may want to become bodybuilders and choose to do so, but if we do not want to become bodybuilders, we cannot make ourselves into someone who does want to be a bodybuilder. For that to happen, there would have to be another self inside us who made us choose to want to become bodybuilders. And inside that self, there would have to be still another self who made that self want to choose to make us want to become bodybuilders. This sequence of choosing, being interminable, would result in the paradox of an infinite number of selves beyond which there is a self making all the choices. The foregoing position is based in a strain of philosophical thought called determinism, and is here stated in one of its strongest forms. British philosopher Galen Strawson describes this position, which is his own as a determinist, as pessimistic. It is pessimistic because it turns the human image into a puppet image, and a puppet image of humanity is one of the hallmarks of pessimism. Those who most vehemently oppose the pessimistic form of determinism are libertarian indeterminists. They hold that we have absolute free will and can make ourselves into individuals who can choose to want to make a certain choice and not some other. They hold that we are what Michael Stetter despaired we could ever become, individuals who are invulnerably self-possessed and not the products of an indeterminable series of events and conditions that result in our being able to make only one choice and not any number of choices, because factors beyond our control have already taken care of who we are as individuals and what choices we will finally make. In the history of philosophical lucubration, arguments for determinism are traditionally the most argued against. Why is this so, aside from the fact that it turns the human image into a puppet image? It is so because arguments for determinism step on the sacrosanct belief in moral responsibility. Even the average atheist draws the line whenever someone says that we do not have any degree of freedom and that moral responsibility is not a reality. As die-hard unbelievers, they may reject the position that moral laws descend from a higher plane unperceived by our senses. As tax-paying citizens, however, they still need to live by sublunary standards of civility. And this can be done only if free will and moral realism are the law of the land. Of course, there are rare cases when a wrongdoer's malfeasance is determined to be the result of determining forces. Then free will and moral responsibility are waived, and the defendant is either sent to a psychiatric hospital rather than a prison, or gets off scot-free because a certain judge and jury in a certain society temporarily become strong determinists without a sense of moral realism, thereby turning the human image of a defendant into a puppet image. But this is highly irregular. In the normal course of events, both determinists and indeterminists are one in promoting some kind of operative morality. As guardians of our morale, they feel moral realism to be a necessary truth, whether it is objectively real, as it is to indeterminists, or subjectively real, as it is to determinists. Without this truth, or truth, we could not go on living as we always have, and believe that being alive is all right. It does not seem wildly improbable that determinations have been made in our psyches that make some people determinists and others indeterminists. If we could only know how these determinations work, we would be able to answer the only interesting question in the debate pitting free will against determinism. Why argue for one side or the other? The answer to this question would abort all rivalry in this matter, since it would bring to light the reason why any philosopher would engage in a conflict more vain than most in his discipline. But should we ever get an answer to this question, the repercussions would far override matters of moral realism or realism. Really, there would only be one repercussion: to reduce all philosophical proclivities to the psychology of the individuals who exhibit them. In his Metaphilosophy and Free Will, Richard Double speaks of analytic philosophers whose writing is protective of free will. Although this type of free will writing pays dividends in terms of precision, it has its disadvantages. First, we may lose sight of the philosophical forest for the technical trees. Second, and following from the first, we may collect psychological consolation at the expense of candor. By submerging ourselves in the nuances of theories, we may avert our attention from the big, scary questions. An attention to detail can be an exercise in bad faith when it uses up our time and energies so that we do not bother to question whether what we are trying to do is possible. Meticulous precision can enable us to remain happy and engaged at the expense of averting our eyes from the disturbing big picture. Perhaps one day, cognitive psychologists will settle once and for all why an individual would argue for either free will or determinism. Studies might also be conducted on those who cling to one side or the other of any philosophical question. This may not advance any philosophical questions, although it might make them disappear once the argumentative motives behind them have been determined. In the everyday world, no such thing as an out-and-out determinist ever existed, since everyday people cannot shake off a sense of having free will. The best we can do is to reason that we are determined based on observing the common law of causality among things in the world and applying this law to ourselves. But we cannot feel ourselves as determined. One philosopher has said, and possibly more have thought to themselves, can one really believe in determinism without going insane? Being determined in thought and deed is not experientially noticeable, only abstractly deducible. It would be impossible for someone to say, "I am nothing but a human puppet." The only exception would be an individual with a psychological disease that had induced in him the sense of being controlled by an alien force. Should this individual say, "I am nothing but a human puppet," he would forthwith be marched to the nearest psychiatric hospital, conceivably overtaken by the horror of feeling he was a human puppet controlled by an alien force working outside him or within him or both. The extent to which any of this is determined in thought and deed may be logically argued, but cannot be known by first-hand experience. Determinists are only too aware that if free will is illusory on paper, it is insuperable in our lives. To hate our illusions or hold them dear only lashes us to them more tautly. We cannot stand up to them without our world falling apart, for those who care. And those who really care cannot be anything but believers in some form of moral realism or realism, which buttresses the optimistic reality that most people call home, and braces up everything you need in order to be you, your country, your loved ones, your job or vocation, your golf clubs, and, in an all-around sense, your way of life. Impersonation. In the free will debate, the reality, or reality, of free will is something of an irrelevancy, since it is a parasite of the feeling we each have of being or possessing a self, often capitalized. This self is an intangible entity that is spoken of as if it were an extra internal organ, yet to every one of us it seems more than the sum of our anatomical parts. Everything comes back to the self and must come back to the self, for it is the utmost issue in our deciding whether we are something or nothing, people or puppets. Without the sense of being or possessing a self, there would be no use disputing whether or not we are free, determined, or somewhere in between. Why we have a sense of self has been variously explained. For one explanation, see the next section in this chapter. Having this sense is what brings the free will versus determinism debate to the table. Even further, it is what brings everything to the table, or at least to the table of human existence, because nothing else that exists has a sense of being a self that can do or not do anything at will. You can reason that you do not have a self and that your behavior is determined, but if you feel that you are or possess a self, then you will probably have a time of it denying responsibility for every thought that passes through your brain or the slightest movement of your little toe. Yet there is a problem with the feeling of responsibility, because sometimes you feel responsible for something that you cannot, by any logic or physical law, be held responsible for. When someone dies of an undiagnosed case of liver cancer not long after he punches you in the stomach, you cannot say, "That's what he gets for messing with me." Yet people do say such things in such circumstances. Nevertheless, they can usually be brought to their senses about feeling somehow responsible for the death by unrelated causes of someone who has punched them in the stomach. More often, though, an individual cannot be brought to his senses when he feels responsible for something that he cannot, by any logic or physical law, be held responsible for. For example, you call up a friend or a relative to help you fix your toilet, and while driving over to your place to do this, he is hit by an 18-wheel truck and dies. It would not be out of the ordinary if you felt responsible for your friend or relative's death, for the reason that if you had not called him up to help fix your toilet, he would not have been on the road at that time and gotten killed in a collision with an 18-wheel truck. Under these circumstances, your friends and relatives who are still alive may find it difficult to convince you of your non-responsibility in the death of your friend or relative who died in a vehicular misadventure. There may be any number of factors involved in that fatal collision, but you could still feel that the only factor worth consideration was your calling up your friend or relative to drive over to your place when he would otherwise have been doing something you had nothing to do with. You would be mistaken to feel this way, of course, but just because you can reason that you are mistaken would not in itself make you feel any less responsible for what happened. And you may mistakenly take that feeling of terrible responsibility to your grave, because you were the self who called another self to come to your place to help fix your toilet. You might just as well blame your toilet for going out of order when it did, or blame any number of causes back to the beginning of time as much as blame yourself. The thing is this: if you can be mistaken in attributing to yourself responsibility, or anything more than a bare trace of causal responsibility, you can also be mistaken about other things, such as being a self with free will. But if you feel that you are or possess a self, then you will probably have a time of it denying responsibility for every thought that passes through your brain or the slightest movement of your little toe. Other people may try to console you for your friend or relative's death by saying that this atrocious event was not your fault. They may also surreptitiously blame you for it, as people sometimes blame those who have had a heart attack for being lax in following the unhealthy injunction to watch your health. But it is quite possible you will disbelieve anyone who says you are not to blame for your friend or relative's death in a vehicular misadventure, perhaps because you can tell that they surreptitiously blame you for it. But that is inconsequential. As someone who feels he is a self, you will likely as not feel responsible for things you could not by any logic or physical law take responsibility for, or no more than a bare trace of causal responsibility. This is not even to consider circumstances in which you may feel morally responsible for something that happens, when by rights you should not feel this way. And here is where the feeling of being a self with free will really comes in. Say you asked your friend or relative to help fix your toilet, not because you needed help fixing your toilet, but because you wanted to get back at him for asking you to help him move into his new house the week before, when he could have called a moving company, as you did when you moved into your new house, and saved you from having your little toe broken when a heavy piece of furniture fell on it during the move. Morally, inconveniencing your friend or relative just to get back at him for the reasons stated in the previous sentence was not the right thing to do, or so you feel after your friend or relative's car crashed when it collided with an 18-wheel truck in an explosive vehicular misadventure. You did not mean for that to happen. You were just looking for some petty form of payback, some kind of reprisal for the pain of your broken toe, and not even a proportional reprisal, nor anything illegal or particularly immoral as these things go. Good luck, though, if you try to feel you were not responsible in an intensely moral sense for your friend or relative's vehicular misadventure. You could reason that your part in this misfortune was causally determined and not your fault. But if you feel that you are or possess a self, then you will probably have a time of it denying responsibility for what happened. If you did not feel this way, what kind of person would that make you, assuming you still felt yourself a person and not some monstrous thing? What is most uncanny about the self is that no one has yet been able to present the least evidence of it. Like the soul, that figure of speech which has long since been snickered out of existence, the self may be felt, but never be found. It is a spectral tapeworm that takes its reality from a host organism and grows along with the physical matter in which it is encased. It may even grow beyond its material confines. Some believe that a big self enfolds all our little selves. Far fewer, or none, believe that little selves can have littler selves, or play host to a number of self-contained selves. Do infants have selves? Fetuses? When do we get a self, and can we lose it, or have it taken away from us? Putting nonsense aside, some of us are surer than others of ourselves. And how many of us want nothing so badly as to be a self-made somebody? Without a relentless sense of the self, the person, we could not live as we have all these years. Were a personal God to be excluded from everyone's universe, persons would still retain their status. Sensory perceptions, memories, aches, ecstasies. Because these phenomena occur inside the same sack of skin, we suppose that we are enduring continuous entities, things that serve as the infrastructure for war, romance, athletic competition, and every other genre of human activity. We do not just have experiences. We own them. That is what it means to be a person. No quibbling, everyone who is anyone holds this article of faith, even those who, like the 18th-century Scottish philosopher David Hume, have done a good job of logically dismantling the reality of selves. But logic cannot exorcise that I, ego, which stares back at you in the mirror, just as logic cannot remove the illusion of free will. When someone says she has not been feeling her old self, our thoughts turn to psychology, not metaphysics. To reason or to hold as an article of faith that the self is an illusion may help us to step around the worst pitfalls of the ego, but mitigation is light years from liberation. To all human beings, or almost all, we seem to be the most real thing going. No one can say with assurance what the world outside of us is like, but inside us we feel self-assured. How does this occur? So far, no one knows. Cognitive psychologists, philosophers of mind, and neuroscientists have their theories, of course, among them those that argue for temporary selves and selves over time, psychophysical selves, neurological selves, objective selves, subjective selves, social selves, transcendent selves, the self as a process and not a thing, and even the simultaneous existence and non-existence of the self. But these and many other self-concepts leave the self as we have always known and experienced it, intact and unharmed. We will all, or almost all, still feel that we are or possess an old-fashioned self. Thus, cognitive psychologists, philosophers of mind, and neuroscientists who extend theories that the self does not exist as we have always believed are not saying that the self does not exist. They are only spreading complex self-constructions that save the self from anyone's questioning its existence. And those who try to prove that selves do not look out at the world from behind our eyeballs might as well be telling us that we have been snatched by the body snatchers, or coalesced into the thing. Within the hierarchy of fabrications that compose our lives, families, countries, gods, the self incontestably ranks highest. Just below the self is the family, which has proven itself more durable than national or ethnic affiliations, with these in turn outranking god figures for their staying power. So, any progress toward the salvation of humankind will probably begin from the bottom, when our gods have been devalued to the status of refrigerator magnets or lawn ornaments. Following the death rattle of deities, it would appear that nations or ethnic communities are next in line for the boneyard. Only after fealty to countries, gods, and families has been shucked off can we even think about coming to grips with the least endangered of fabrications, the self. However, this hierarchy may change in time as science makes inroads regarding the question of selfhood, which, if the findings are negative, could reverse the progression, with the extinction of the self foretelling that of families, national and ethnic affiliations, and gods. After all, the quintessential sequence by which we free ourselves from ourselves and our institutions is still that depicted in the Buddha legend. Born a prince, so the story goes, the nascent enlightened one, Siddhartha Gautama, embarked on a quest to neutralize his ego by first leaving behind his family, gods, and socio-political station, all in one stroke. But Buddha's way requires a near-inhuman dedication, and few of us have that kind of stamina. This being so, a speedy and efficient breakdown of fabrications having a worldwide ambit seems remote without the intercession of science, which could at some future date provide a vaccination against the development of selves after models already in use to wipe out certain diseases. Perhaps the only matter of interest about the self is this. Whatever makes us think that we are what we think we are lies in the fact that we have consciousness, which gives us a sense of being somebody, specifically a human somebody, whatever that may be, since we do not have a definition of human on which there is universal agreement. But we do agree that, if only in practice, we are all real live selves, since we are all self-conscious. And, once we have passed through every door that qualifies ourselves in some way, be it by name, nationality, occupation, gender, or shoe size, we then stand before the door of consciousness, parent of all horrors. And that is all there is to our existence. No creature caged in a zoo even knows what it is to exist, nor does it crow about being superior to another kind of thing, whether animal, vegetable, or mineral. As for us humans, we reek of our sense of being special. Those hailed as the most conscious among us, the ones needful of a refined type of brainwashing, have made investigations into what it means to be human. Their divergent ramblings on this subject keep our brains buzzing, while our bodies go the way of surviving and reproducing, being alive, that is, since we do not especially consider the alternative. That being human might mean something very strange and awful, something quite uncanny, is not given a passing thought. If it were, who knows what would happen to us? We could disappear in a puff of smoke, or fall through a mirror that has nothing on the other side. Naturally, such possibilities do not lift our spirits the way we need them to be lifted, if we are to continue to live as we have all these years.